Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast.
Tonight on Primetime Politics, putting the carbon tax to a vote.
We cannot, in good conscience, stand by while this Prime Minister imposes more misery and suffering on the Canadian people.
Conservatives failed to pass a non-confidence motion, but they continue to challenge the Trudeau Liberals to let voters decide the fate of the carbon levy. With public opinion souring on the policy, can the Liberals continue to resist calls to kill or at least reduce the tax? We'll put the question to our political panel. And
there's a real sense of terror, a lot of fear, trauma.
The chaos, the violence, and the humanitarian crisis in Haiti. Coming up, we'll speak to Canada's ambassador to the Caribbean country to talk about the safety of nearly 3,000 Canadians still on the ground. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. Conservatives continue to hammer the governing Liberals on the carbon tax, tonight using their opposition motion to force a vote of non-confidence in the Trudeau government.
We, as common sense conservatives, are ready to restore hope in this country, but it starts with change. We rise today to vote non-confidence in this NDP Liberal government and to restore the great country that we love.
But it was not meant to be. Poilievre's motion failed in the House of Commons, but it does not end the criticism about the carbon levy. Scheduled to go up on April the 1st, conservatives want that increase killed and say Canadians should decide the fate of the tax altogether with a general election. Well, joining us now is our weekly political panel. Stevie O'Brien is a senior advisor at Macmillan Vantage. She's also a former chief of staff to three Liberal cabinet ministers. Sean Murphy is a principal at Earnscliffe Strategies and a former senior conservative staffer. And Anne McGrath, principal secretary to the federal NDP leader, Jagmeet Singh. Hello to the three of you.
Hello.
Hi.
So listen, let's begin with this motion of non-confidence. It wasn't expected to pass, as we know, but you know, what does it say about the vulnerability of the government's carbon policy? Because, you know, conservatives would not be hitting on this issue time and again, and if they didn't think it was actually getting traction.
Well, I think partly it's getting traction because there was a big mistake made. You know, that I think that the carve out of the home heating oil that was very clearly quite divisive and created a lot of, you know, problems from region to region kind of put a bit of a stake in this. It put a nail in it, and it highlighted some of the discontent around it. And I think the Conservatives are seizing on that. I do think, though, that the Conservatives are very vulnerable in that they have no plan, and they have not been able to in any way, number one, indicate that they care even all that much about climate change or that they have any solutions to or a plan of how to deal with it. So I think it's got vulnerabilities on both sides. This is an opposition day motion. It is. They of course, people know that it's not going to pass. But it does highlight an area where people are feeling kind of they can identify it as part of the crunch of affordability right now. And so there are concerns about the price going up on April 1st. And it's a very, very hard policy to communicate because the rebate issue, it just doesn't fly. People don't believe that they're benefiting in any way economically from this. And so I think at a period of time when people are feeling so under the gun when it comes to prices and so forth, it's an easy one to go after.
Yeah, easy to go after, in part because, you know, when you speak to Liberals, they say, well, the issue is not the carbon tax, the issue is inflation. I don't know if that really sells to the average Canadian. How vulnerable is the policy right now, Stevie?
I don't think the vulnerability lies in the policy. The Prime Minister said, it's true, we've run and won three elections on carbon pricing and climate change. So no fears that the next election is going to be run on the same thing. I think the vulnerability is really about the communication strategy around it. And I agree with Anne, it hasn't been, people are seeing it as a tax. They are not fully appreciating how the rebate piece works, that 80%...
Which is the rebrand.
Well, I would say it wasn't even a rebrand. They should have been. This was always part of the package, and it just didn't get communicated in a way where people understood how it worked and how it was going to benefit them. And I think they need to double down on that, and it's going to be difficult. Polyev has done a really good job with catchy slogans like Axe the Tax and really tapping in and to that affordability concerns and personal finance stress of most Canadians.
Mm-hmm. Sean, do you think a communications challenge or vulnerable?
Well, I don't think it's a communications challenge because it's I don't know how you possibly could tell people who are having that sticker shock when they're shopping and when they're gassing up their cars that they're better off at the end of the month. You can tell them that the rebates are coming, but the numbers don't lie. And the parliamentary budget officer even mentioned it this week at the committee, saying that that. On balance, on average, most people are worse off at the end of the month. So this is clearly an affordability issue, and the carbon tax has a big piece to play in that. And it going up in 10 days by 23%, people are taking notice. And this motion in particular, obviously there have been many on the carbon tax. This is an opportunity, well, not an opportunity, but this is going to, you know, further tie the NDP to the Liberals in terms of affordability issues and this tax in particular.
Okay, which I'll get you to respond to in a second. But, you know, I wanted to pick up on Anne's point, though, because despite, the slogans of axing the tax, there's still the big question, what would Conservatives do? How can they keep hitting on this issue if they're not actually offering an alternative? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, it's for the last 8 years, it almost seems like there's been a tunnel vision in media and not you, Michael, but in Ottawa and in this country, thinking that carbon tax was the only way to reduce emissions in Canada. Whereas you look around the world, and it's not necessarily the case. Certainly, to our south, President Biden doesn't think he needs a carbon tax. Now, what Polyev has said in the past, and I suppose we'll see a lot more of that as time gets as we get closer to a federal election. But they have talked about small modular reactors, wind power, tidal power, hydrogen investments, and that's the kind of thing that they will be focusing on, I suspect. But they'll also be looking at ways to speed those kinds of processes up by reforming or eliminating the way that those projects are evaluated in the Impact Assessment Act.
Mm-hmm. Anne, what do you say to that?
Well, I would say I find it ironic in a way because a consumer carbon price is actually a conservative idea. I mean, it was conservatives that proposed this. It's conservatives that have been the biggest champions of it. So this is a bit of a shift in many ways. So it is a conservative policy proposal. That's where it came from. I do agree that it should not be seen as the only thing in climate, doing something about the climate. And I think that the other things, like for instance, some of the things that Sean just mentioned I think are important, but also going after some of the biggest polluters, which are industrial polluters, big oil companies, big gas companies. And I think that will also create issues for, I would say, both the Liberals and the Conservatives, who are much more tied to those big industrial polluter companies. And we've been calling for things like getting rid of the subsidies, the fossil fuel subsidies, and climate change plans that are kind of comprehensive, include caps on emissions and ending fossil fuel subsidies and making the big polluters pay.
Mm-hmm. Stevie?
Well, I think before the Conservatives can put out a credible climate policy, they probably need to get some sort of consensus amongst their own caucus that climate change is real. That would probably be a helpful first step. But beyond that, I agree that we need multiple tools in the box to fight climate policy, to fight climate change. The carbon pricing system is just one of the tools. It alone is insufficient, but it is part of the broader attack. If with the everything together, all of the ambitious policies that the government's pursuing, if they were all done, we can hit our targets, and that's pretty remarkable. If we pull back from any one of the strategies that's been put forward, we won't hit our 2030 targets. So this is still an essential piece to keep in play.
Okay, an essential piece, as you say. But, you know, there was, of course, the Canadian Climate Institute. They came out with a new report basically saying that when you look at it, the industrial carbon tax is working really well. The consumer one is not working as well. So given the fact that there's so much opposition and so much criticism of the carbon tax as it exists right now, can the Liberal government continue to resist either cutting it or at least changing it before the next election?
I think there's going to be an immense amount of pressure on a pause, but we've seen the Prime Minister sort of double down on it, and I don't think he can back away from his stance at this point. But I would point out as well, just my friend, that Biden doesn't have a need for a carbon tax, but I believe that's because a lot of it's happening at the state level. So, mm-hmm.
Sean?
Whether
or not the government can resist either changing or killing it, given the opposition around it.
I think on that, they are. It is too tied to their legacy at this point and to their record from the past 8 years to backtrack on it or to axe it entirely would be a hit at their own credibility on their signature policy and on across the board really. If you're willing to backtrack on your biggest most signature piece, then what won't you backtrack on? And further, I wouldn't trust that it would last. If they were to pause the increase, that just means that they're going to increase it later. I think right now what Canadians want to see is the carbon tax eliminated outright so that they can have some relief at the end of the month.
Okay. Can I just mention also that when they did the home heating oil thing, mm-hmm. that was backing off their signature climate policy, and it backfired. It did not get them any of the benefits that they thought that it was going to get them, and it opened the door to some of the debate that's happening right now. So then, so backing off, they've already done it, and it's already caused them a lot of pain.
So basically they have to keep the course.
I think they have to keep the course, but they have a hard time with it because of that carve-out.
Yeah.
It will be helpful if inflation keeps going down and we see food prices dropping like we did earlier this week, which might suggest that food prices and affordability issues are not tied to carbon pricing. But it'll be helpful if the economy turns around for sure to continue with the policy.
Okay, quickly, if you want one more word.
Oh, I'll just say, look, it's one thing for things to appear to be going down, but they are certainly going up, or the tax is certainly going up in 9 days. And so we'll see what the effect of that is.
Okay. Stevie, Sean, Anne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To St. Patrick's Basilica in Montreal now, where the body of former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney arrived earlier today. Escorted by the RCMP and carried to a place of honour. This is where Mr. Mulroney will now lie in repose between today and Saturday's state funeral. A group of sentinels will guard the casket as dignitaries and members of the public come to pay their respects and to sign the official book of condolences. Among the first to attend today, former Quebec Premier and former Mulroney Cabinet Minister Jean Charest, who will deliver one of the eulogies at Mr. Mulroney's funeral on Saturday. Also paying his respects this morning, former Quebec Premier and the founding leader of the Bloc Québécois, Lucien Bouchard. A longtime friend of Mr. Mulroney, the two fell out for decades over Bouchard's decision to leave the Mulroney government and sit with a coalition of Quebec MPs that would become the Bloc. But the two did recently reconcile.
Of course, it's a very emotional moment when you turn a page. History, of course, is a chapter of history of Canada and Quebec, which is now closed. And personally, of course, it's a very intense remembrance of our years of youth, because our friendship goes back to those years when we were 20. 20 is a great age, to be. Yeah. It's sad. At the same time, I think that someone like Brian Mulroney leaves behind him hope for young people who live a lot of anxiety now, because of the situation, great situation, and great challenges for them, great opening, but at the same time, it's very tough competition and everything. So they just think about, let them think about Brian Mulroney, a young guy from Bécancour, coming to Quebec, almost not speaking French, and becoming what he became. Start from nothing, start from scratch. And everything rests on his talent, on his love of people, on his touch with people. And so people of today, young people, should remember that.
The official ceremonies honoring the late Prime Minister will continue tomorrow. Public visitations at St. Patrick's Basilica will start again Friday at 10 a.m. And then on Saturday, the funeral cortege will make its way from St. Patrick's to Montreal's Notre-Dame Basilica. And this is where Mr. Mulroney's state funeral will take place. Now, CPAC will continue to bring you full coverage for the remainder of this week. And on Saturday, we will broadcast the state funeral right here on our channel and online at cpac.ca. Time now for a look at what happened in politics today. The NDP is calling on the federal government to continue funding searches for unmarked graves at former residential school sites. The party's Deputy Indigenous Services critic, Nikki Ashton, joined First Nations leaders in urging the Trudeau Liberals to renew project funding in the upcoming budget. There are concerns that program support for Indigenous Services Canada, including for the International Commission on Missing Persons, which helps with the searches, could run out in 2025.
Communities need answers. They need to be able to bring their children home. Cuts to this program and other such programs fly in the face of seeking truth and reconciliation. We are asking for these cuts, this sunsetting, to be reversed.
Newfoundland and Labrador's finance minister delivered her government's budget this afternoon after protests outside the provincial legislature prevented her from tabling it yesterday. Hundreds of fishers and their supporters blocked entrances to the Confederation Building in St. John's on Wednesday, forcing the government to delay the budget. The demonstrators are angry with the province's fisheries regulations that banned them from selling their catch outside the province. Crowds gathered again this morning, prompting a heavy police presence, including officers in riot gear and on horseback. The opposition benches were notably empty during the budget speech, as the Progressive Conservatives and the NDP chose not to enter the legislature, siding with the fishers. And finally tonight, the National Defense Minister is tabling legislation that will remove the Canadian military from the investigation and prosecution of sex crimes within its ranks. Going forward, it will go to civilian authorities. Bill Blair made the announcement as he outlined changes to the National Defense Act meant to address recommendations from two former Supreme Court justices to reform a toxic culture in the armed forces.
This is the right thing to do for the men and women who serve in the Canadian Armed Forces. We've heard very clearly from victims and survivors and from other members of the Canadian Armed Forces. This legislation is really for all of them, to create a safe, supportive, and respectful work environment for every member of the Canadian Armed Forces to work in.
Extremely alarming. That is how UN officials are now describing the situation in Haiti. For months, gangs have been putting innocent people at risk, and as the violence escalates, particularly in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince, the humanitarian needs grow. This afternoon, we heard from the UN's humanitarian coordinator, and she says nearly half the country is in need of food, water, and medical supplies, a situation made more dire by the seizing of humanitarian shipments a few days ago.
The gangs continue to systematically use sexual violence. They do it to have control, but also revenge. It's horrific reports of collective rape on women and girls. They use torture. And in fact, what we are seeing also as a result of this, let's say the advance of the gangs is that we now have a situation of actually 5.5 million of the 11.4 population is in need of some type of humanitarian assistance. And that is, as you can imagine, is a significant number. And out of those 5.5, 3 million are children.
Well, we are now joined by Canada's ambassador to Haiti, André-François Giroux. Ambassador, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure to be with you.
Listen, I want to begin with some of the latest news that we're getting, beginning with this news about shipping containers carrying humanitarian supplies now taken by criminal gangs. What impact will this have on the situation in Haiti, do you think?
Well, the gangs have gained control of many parts of Port-au-Prince. The police doing a wonderful job in their circumstances, but what we have been seeing and what we will see is incidents like the one you just described. So unfortunately, this is not new and it's not going to be over either. But I can assure you that there are definitely strong forces out there to make sure that overall humanitarian goods and services do manage to reach their targeted audience.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the great concern here is the number of Haitians right now who are in great need of humanitarian supplies. How would you describe the situation right now in the country? You know, we get a sense of it through the pictures and the video that we're getting from Haiti, but from you on the ground, how would you describe the situation?
Well, Haiti has been facing this political, security, and humanitarian crisis for quite a few years. Almost 50% of the population suffers from insecurity, food insecurity. So this is not new, unfortunately. And there has been wonderful efforts that have been going on for months, for years. What we've seen recently is an increase of gang violence and gang coordinating themselves to try to seize power. In parallel, that has really triggered the stakeholders, political, civil society, business community, to come together and really fill the void. And this is, in my view, very good news. So a week ago, under the leadership of the CARICOM, the Caribbean community, what we've seen is the framework for a transitional government that would lead Haiti towards election, which wasn't possible before, and now is in our view a very positive development. So political crisis is being resolved right now. It is necessary to help with the other two crises, which is security and humanitarian. So, you know, it is tremendous, the work that needs to happen, but I would say we should definitely celebrate every little win and hope for the best.
Yeah, every little win, as you say, although, you know, I think we have to note the fact that the top gang leader in Haiti is Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, and reportedly he's already threatening families of political leaders who actually would support a transition council for Haiti. What does that tell you about the challenges that still lie ahead?
Well, it's true that this transitional council is going to face a lot of resistance from the gangs because for them, it's threatening. It's threatening. Their business model is drug trafficking, human trafficking, kidnapping, and so on and so forth. So the fact that these political forces are coming together to pad the way towards constitutional order, to pad the way towards election and also welcome the multinational security force is really not good news for the gang. So we will see a lot of those threats going forward. We will see a lot of insecurity, unfortunately. But, you know, it is what it is. I do believe that the political forces are taking the steps to make sure that we are well placed to welcome that multinational security force and eventually turn the corner
down the road. But in the meantime, right now, again, it is that violence on the ground. There are, and this is to my understanding, some nearly 3,000 registered Canadians in Haiti. Are there any plans to evacuate those Canadians out of country?
Well, it is part of my role and with the assistance of Ottawa to be ready for any eventuality. But you have to keep in mind that our travel advisory has been saying for the last 2 years, don't come to Haiti. If you are here, leave the country. So the reality is that those Canadians that are here came here with open eyes, are very well prepared, like we are, like I am, and shelter in place, have water, food, medicine, avoid unnecessary transportation or movement, and wait for the storm to pass. It's unfortunate. It's a little uncomfortable, but the reality is that right now options for assisted departure are very limited, considering the fact that the airport isn't secure.
What is the criteria? At what point would you consider an emergency evacuation of Canadian nationals?
The situation would have, I believe, to be much more critical than it is right now, because the reality is if you do follow those security advice, depending on where you are, it is manageable. So, but as I said, we are getting ready for every eventuality. We are talking to our allies, because it's not just Canadians, it's other nationals that may wish to depart at one point. So we will make sure, we are making sure that we are well coordinated and ready.
You know, quickly running out of time, Ambassador, but I do have to ask, because the situation continues to change, as you know, on the ground in Haiti. There's much coming down the pipes. But what role does that then leave for Canada in this moment? How best can this country support the Haitian people?
Well, a lot of our activities over the past few years and definitely in recent months have been to really help the PNH, the National Police, Haitian Police, to rebuild itself. So our programs are continuing. We have been investing $100 million in equipment for the police, training and technical advice. We are mobilizing the international community, donor community, to make sure that we're well coordinated and we're really answering the needs of the police, prioritizing what's really required. And in addition to that, we've just announced $80 million to support the multinational security force. So we are everywhere. We are intervening, acting at every level. And those efforts are taking place right now and will carry on in the future.
Ambassador Giroux, do take care of yourself. Thank you very much for the time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And, of course, we'll continue to track the story. That is our program for this Thursday. I'm Michael Serapio. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching. Primetime Politics will be back tomorrow. But up next, Esteban Jean avec l'Essentiel.